This is West Southwest on WMUK. I'm Earlene McMichael. On November 6th, history-making feminist Gloria Steinem spoke to a packed house at Miller Auditorium at Western Michigan University. Today, West Southwest looks back at 2015 with an encore presentation of my interview with Steinem, with some previously unaired segments added in. Welcome to our program.
Thank you so much. I'm at home in Michigan again.
Oh, yes. I guess I'll start off and say that you're a Midwesterner. That's where you were born.
Yes.
You were born in Toledo, Ohio. Is that correct?
Yes. I was born there because my parents' families, both of them, came from there. But we immediately moved to Michigan. They took me as an infant to Michigan, where we were living in Clark Lake, which is about 12 miles south of Jackson.
Were you actually raised here then?
Until I was 10, yes. Michigan was home. Absolutely.
Amazing, amazing. I did not know that. Let us go back in time. I remember reading about the genesis of your HBO documentary about you called Gloria in Her Own Words, which you authorized and were a part of. And one of the things that stuck out of my mind is about how some individuals, younger people, may not know of your legacy. But I know you also talked about how you're very surprised that quite a few women do. So let's kind of revisit that for a moment. Could you bring us back in time in the 1960s? How was it different for women then compared to now?
It's hard to know where to begin. But if, for instance, you went to get an airline reservation or get a ticket, you had to say your marital status. They would get quite angry if you didn't. And that's why the term Ms., which actually was an old English term, centuries old, was resurrected in order to have an exact parallel to Mr. So there was no more reason why women had to give their marital status than why men did. Or if you went to the bank to get a loan, you had to get your husband or your father usually to sign with you. Or if you and your husband were getting a loan, you had to get a so-called baby letter. That is a guarantee that you would not have a baby during the time before the loan was repaid. If you tried to get a credit card, there were all kinds of, you know, similar restrictions in the sense of your not being a totally trustworthy financial person in the view of the law. If you went into a restaurant, it was possible that especially at lunchtime, it would be for men only because it was said that women's voices might disturb men's serious business discussions at lunch. Oh, well, we could go on.
That's quite a bit. And I think that that's something that people forget. They do forget that those types of things used to happen. I was reading about a lecture that you gave or a presentation at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, and that was June of this year, in which you said that the suffragist movement and the abolitionist movements took about 100 years to kind of achieve their goals. And that we could expect a similar time period for progress for gender and racial equity. And that we were, you said, about halfway there. What do you think could help speed gender equality forward? What yet needs to be done?
Well, you know, anything could help speed it. I think that we become too concerned with saying, what should I do? And fail to do whatever we can. So suppose you're going to get a job, do a little research on how much the job is paid before and ask for a fair amount of money because that is what the job is worth. Or if you are, you know, looking at the political scene, which can be quite discouraging, especially right now, nonetheless, always remember that the only place on earth where the very poorest and the very richest are equal is in the ballot box. So, you know, the effort to say politics is dirty, it doesn't matter, your vote doesn't matter, is a very conscious effort to discourage us from voting. We have among the lowest turnout rates of any democracy in the world. Also, it's important to remember that these kinds of systems of discrimination go together. They're not separate movements. You know, so the motivation to control women has been a patriarchal one in order to control reproduction. And that redoubles as soon as there is a system based on race or class or caste, as in India, because the need to restrict who has children with whom becomes greater in order to maintain those systems of discrimination. You know, I think when movements begin, we are understandably making ourselves visible and telling our stories to each other so we know we're neither crazy nor alone, and naming problems and naming groups for the first time. So it's a period of independence, but soon comes a period of interdependence as we begin to realize that all the social justice movements are intertwined.
As part of that presentation at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, you talked about pink-collar jobs and that those are mostly filled by women, predominantly women of color, like home health care and food service workers. And you were saying that one thing that can be done to quite speed things along is equal pay for equal work.
Well, to start with equal pay, I think we need to understand that it is in everyone's self-interest. It would be, well, not in the self-interest of Walmart and other people who are profiteering, but mostly everybody's interest because it's an economic stimulus. You know, actually, equal pay for equal work would be the very best economic stimulus this country could have. It would put about $200 billion more in the economy, and those women are unlikely to dash away their money in a Swiss bank account. You know, they're going to spend it, they need it, and it causes the economy to prosper.
In March of this year, you had an interview with Black Enterprise Magazine, that's a business magazine, in which you were talking about a lot of different topics, but one of them was the impact Black women had on the feminist movement. And there are some that believe that perhaps that movement has and still perhaps excludes them. And I was intrigued by your response. You said, "I thought they invented the feminist movement. I know we all have different experiences, but I learned feminism disproportionately from Black women." And actually, I'll go a step further. There's another part of a quote there that I found interesting. I realized that things being said what they are, probably the white middle class part of the movement got reported more.
You know, I find this extremely frustrating, and some of it is real, of course, because there is a profound racism in this country, and some of it is an effort to divide us so that we don't make too much trouble. But in the very first issue of, or one of the first issues of Ms. Magazine, for instance, we did a poll, a national Lou Harris poll of women's opinions on women's issues. It may have been the first one. And in response, Black women were about 60% in support of a women's liberation movement with its issues, and white women only about 30%. So it is true statistically, and I know it's not true for everyone personally, but it happened to be true for me personally, because, for instance, I'd been working with the National Welfare Rights Organization, and the women, and it was mostly women and mostly Black women on welfare, had done a wonderful, humorous examination of the welfare system as if it were a gigantic husband that was jealous and looked under your bed for the shoes of other men. And so, I mean, it was really quite witty and smart, and it was the first feminist analysis of social policy that I'd ever heard. Then also, accidentally, because I was afraid to speak in public myself, I'd never done it, I teamed up with a friend who was fearless. And because we were a white and Black woman together, we got audiences that we would not have been able to get separately, I'm sure. So I began to see how important it was to speak a variety of experiences and to come together on solutions or at least steps forward that were useful to the widest possible group.
Speaking of bringing different types of groups together, there was even diversity in opinion within even the feminist movement at the time, even at the start of Ms. Magazine. There's always a spectrum within a movement. Even when you think of racial equality, you think of the approach of Malcolm X versus the approach of Martin Luther King, civil disobedience versus maybe taking up arms or doing something more. So there was a spectrum of opinion even in terms of feminism. And so when I asked you earlier to talk about the time in which Ms. Magazine was founded in the early 70s, it was a radical thing for its time. But there might have been some people perhaps who might have thought that it could have been more radical, that there are many voices in terms of feminism out there. What did you learn about, gosh, how to proceed when there's so many different voices within a movement?
Well, you try to listen to each other, first of all. That's the most crucial thing. And present in, if you're doing a magazine, a wide variety of experiences so that there is one thing or two things in each issue for a particular kind of experience, even though the whole issue is not going to be of interest to everybody. But actually, I mean, the main complaint about Ms. was that we were too radical at the time. For instance, here's an example, because I think examples are already always better than generalities. The editor at the time of Newsweek took me to lunch and said that told me kindly that the only way a feminist magazine could possibly succeed would be to be the heterosexual magazine against the lesbian part of the movement. Can you imagine? So, of course, that made it clear we had to have an article by and about lesbians in the very first issue, which we did. But at that point, it was still not an issue on which the National Organization for Women, at least in New York, was united. Of course, now it is. So, you know, a magazine is actually more fortunate than many places because you can represent variety.
Has your definition of feminism changed? And if so, how? And do you believe it to be universal or a first world concept?
You know, the words change, of course. Feminism still means what it says in the dictionary, which is the belief in the full social, economic, political equality of males and females. And a feminist is someone who believes that and supports that, whether it's a woman or a man or, you know, a child or a grown-up. You know, that's what feminism is. The word in English is probably more of a Western concept, but the fact is that the reality of it is definitely not a Western concept. For instance, when I first got out of college, I lived in India for 2 years, and the women's movement there was very, very well developed because they had been active against the British in all kinds of ways, but trying to combat child marriage and sati and all kinds of things. And Gandhi actually learned a lot of his tactics from the women's movement. So for that reason, they were in advance in consciousness in many cases, not perhaps in the reality of life, but in consciousness of a women's movement, they were way in advance of this country. There's no, there's no competition of tiers. Tears are tears wherever they exist, and we need to support each other. In a generalized way, patriarchy is the problem, vastly increased by race and caste and class, where that is overlaid on patriarchy, and we're all working on it in different ways.
You've been listening to Gloria Steinem on West Southwest. Here in the United States, we associate Steinem with the women's movement, but she's also highly involved with efforts addressing women's equity and violence against women at the international level. Steinem recently joined forces with Navi Pillai, former United Nations High Commissioner for Human Rights and lifelong women's rights advocate in South Africa. Steinem and Pillai are co-leading the steering committee of Donor Direct. That's a group that's using the internet to link individuals across the globe with women's rights organizations in need of funding.
Among the great advances of the internet is that it's possible to connect donors in one place to need on the ground in another place without the usual expense of many steps along the way, organizations, foundations, interpreters, all the different steps. So Donor Direct Action takes advantage of that by telling the stories of groups of women on the ground in a wide variety of countries so that donors in other countries can see it. Then the second great advantage is that those groups on the ground, say in Zambia or South Africa or India, don't have tax-exempt status in the U.S. or in England or wherever the donor may be, but Donor Direct Action does. So it enables the donor to have the advantage of tax exemption and directly aid a group whose story they have seen.
It's reached $1 million raised so far, or more than $1 million actually, from donors to help in 40 countries.
Yes, it's quite remarkable because these are not big donations, and in fact, a relatively small amount of money on the ground can make a huge, huge difference. Some of the projects are bigger. For instance, Dr. Mukwege, whose work you may know, who is kind of the hero of trying to mend literally surgically and take care of women who've experienced sexualized violence in wartime and out of wartime. Dr. Mukwege in the Congo has a Panzi hospital and quite a large, how shall I say, center of medical and other help for women. Some of the other groups are much smaller.
What are some of the issues on the international stage that people ought to be concerned about as it regards women? You talked about basically rape of women during wartime. What are some of the others?
Each woman and each group of women and each culture directs itself where the pain is the greatest first. So it's not about making that decision for someone else. We each have to make that decision. But in a generalized way, violence against females worldwide is usually the greatest concern, whatever form it takes on the ground. For instance, now we are seeing in this country an expose, an understanding of sexual assault on campus, of incarcerated women who are forced to even give birth in prison. You know, we're seeing violence against women in one way here, in a different way in the Congo, and in yet a different way in countries like northern India and China, where female infants are discriminated against and done away with to such a degree that there is a huge son surplus and daughter deficit. But if you add up all of those forms of violence against females, it turns out that now for the first time that we know of, there are fewer females on Earth than males. Fewer females on Earth than males. We don't think that's happened before. So this is, you know, this speaks of how important it is that we work against violence wherever we are and whatever form it takes.
The conversation turns to the upcoming presidential election and the fact that there's at least two female candidates running. Gloria Steinem has strong words for presidential candidate Carly Fiorina. She says Fiorina has only helped the cause for women in one way.
She shows that it's not about biology, it's about consciousness. You know, in the same way that an African-American candidate who stands against the issues and needs of the African-American community shows that it's not about race, it's about consciousness. Women are more than smart enough, I think, to see who represents them and who doesn't. But in a general way, it is big step forward for women to be seen as possible candidates in the public world. You know, because we are raised mostly by women, whether we are men or women, we have tended to associate female authority with the home, with emotion, with nurturing, and we haven't seen it as appropriate to the outside world because we haven't experienced it. Really, probably until men are raising children as much as women are and women are in the public world as much as men are, we won't be free to pick human talent from the whole of our population. But at least we've seen enough diverse women in public life so that we now understand that it's possible.
Do you think that a woman will do any better of a job being a president in terms of issues related to women?
You know, it depends who it is. I mean, Margaret Thatcher was a disaster for the women's movement in England. She famously cut off milk for school children as one of her first acts. So it is about consciousness, not simple biology. It is about how the person gets there and who supports her and so on. But even at that, I think there's something to be said for electing people who don't have their masculinity to prove, who have not been culturally rewarded for all of their lives for being at the top of a hierarchy.
That's interesting that you should mention that, because I remember reading somewhere in which you speak to the fact that women weren't raised with having to kind of prove their masculinity. And as a result, you wonder if perhaps maybe they may be better first line responders on the scene as police officers And you were talking about a high rate of domestic abuse among, can you speak a little bit more about that?
I'm glad you mentioned that, because that is a connection, a linkage that would help everyone if we made it. In a general way across country, police officers' families have about four times the incidence of domestic violence compared to families in the population at large. All right, domestic violence is what I think of as a supremacy crime. It has there's no gain. You know, you're not making money or, you know, it's about being hooked on, being addicted to control. And that is the nature of racist crimes as well. They're supremacy crimes. So if we could look at our police force with an understanding of this connection and screen out men who have been violent or controlling in their households, or if not screen them out, perhaps help them get out of that state of mind, because, you know, we don't want to simply exclude people. We want to make it possible to change, but at least make this connection. I think we would clearly have fewer police officers who were acting in a racist way, or in a way that judges people economically.
One more political question. I feel like I would be remiss if I don't ask a Donald Trump question. Why do you think that Donald Trump's message is resonating with a segment of America at this time?
There's one reason I think the political scene in general is at fault for his popularity, and that is that people tend to speak in organizational ease, not authentically. And because he is being authentically biased, you might say, you know, because he's saying blunt, personal things, he is a relief to some people who are tired of political talk. But other than that, it's mostly a function of publicity. If you ask somebody on the street to name three or four of the Republican candidates, they probably couldn't. But everybody knows his name. So he reaches a certain amount of popularity simply on name recognition.
Also, I mentioned kind of off air that I am intrigued by your joie de vivre, joy of living. I mean, at 81, I just think it's amazing. I was looking at clips. You're here. You're there. You travel far and wide. And from the pictures I'm looking at, you look pretty good. You know, what advice, what thoughts do you have for women as they age? What have you learned about aging?
My image of aging is that, you know, the Russian dolls, those nested Russian dolls, you know, with many layers within them. Mm-hmm. I think we're all like Russian dolls. You know, our child self is still inside of us, and then our teenage self and our 20s and so on. So it isn't as if we become different people. We don't. We add to our experience. I'm more shocked than anybody that I'm 81 years old. I keep telling everyone I'm 81 just to try to make myself believe it. But the truth is that with luck, you become more able to be the essence of yourself, you know, with less uncertainty and restriction. I'm trying to especially focus on my age so that I waste less time, because I don't have that much time left. I behave as if I'm immortal, which is, you know, not very realistic. So I am trying to focus on age. But my main message is that you remain the same person, only more so.
I wish I could recall what that quote was that I read, but I think you were talking about the tie to sex and getting older and how that helps you be more focused. Do you recall what you said in regards to that?
This is not about one stage of life being better than another. It's not better. It's just different. Through the central years of life, our hormones and our interests and, you know, I mean, romance and love and sex are sources of great pleasure and bonding and hopefully not abuse, but instead real pleasure and communication. But once your hormones begin to shift, all of those brain cells that were reliably devoted to sex and romance and so on are free for other things. So it's not better or worse, it's just different. It's quite freeing.
Has there been a personal cost to you at all, you think, by pursuing your life path?
You know, I don't really think so, because I feel so lucky to be doing what I love most. I don't think so. The only thing that I myself experience is that the focus on traveling and outside activities of all kinds and issues and campaigning and, you know, everything that a movement entails has caused me to write a lot less than I would have liked. So I do feel that I have a lot of writing backed up inside.
It's at this point that I turned the attention to Gloria Steinem's new book, a memoir titled My Life on the Road. I asked her to tell me about it.
This is an effort to both write about, at a certain point in my life, I realized I was writing least about what I was doing most, which was traveling on the road. I was doing specific articles and essays about topics, but not the process of being on the road itself. And I also realized that movements need traveling organizers, including in the era of the internet. Just as in the suffragist and abolitionist era when Frederick Douglass and Sojourner Truth and the Grimke sisters were, and many others were traveling the country, we still need that very much because something happens when you are physically in a room or an auditorium or the same physical space that cannot happen either on the page or on the screen of a computer. We empathize with each other. Now, I asked a friend of mine who's a neurologist if oxytocin, which is the famous hormone called that allows us to empathize, the tend and befriend hormone, was that produced equally when you're reading or when you're looking at a computer? And the answer is no. We have to be present with all five senses. So I wanted both to talk about my own experiences of being a traveling itinerant organizer and invite others to consider their own way of doing this. It isn't a job that is recruited for, you know, it isn't even a job with a salary. You have to figure out how to freelance your way usually, but it is enormously, enormously satisfying. And for me, it has a special additional reward, which is it forces me to live in the present, much like meditation or mindfulness. When you're on the road, you're forced to live in the present.
You talk about staying in the moment, and it's very rewarding. But I imagine as you have gone through this fight, you've been told no many times. You've had lots of struggles along the way. How do you keep going? How do you keep yourself upbeat?
Well, the most fundamental need is other people who care about similar things and other people you can talk to. You know, we're communal animals. We if we're alone for too long, we come to feel crazy and wrong. So I've been lucky because this is a movement and because of Ms. Magazine and because of friends and, you know, in other countries who are doing similar work, I've been lucky to have this kind of community. I think that's the single most important thing. You really can't do it alone. And the second big lesson here is that if you have an idea of how to create something, make something better, solve a problem, it may not work. You may be turned down, you may be ridiculed, but the worst thing is not to say it because that will haunt you much more. The opposition is secondary. If you don't say it or try it, you will always wonder what if.
Final words, what would you tell young women today?
You know, I wouldn't tell young women. I would listen to young women and say, how can I help? Now, I think just in general, with age or any kind of position of experience or power, then we need to learn to listen as much as we talk. And if we have less power, we need to learn to talk as much as we listen. Then usually we can move forward.
We've been listening to an extended version of an interview with feminist Gloria Steinem that originally aired in October. For more information about Steinem, visit our webpage at wmuk.org. For West Southwest on WMUK, I'm Earlene McMichael.